Welcome to Bodcast, the Business of Dentistry podcast, brought to you by Practice Plan. Bodcast delivers the best business advice, real-life stories, and practical hints and tips to make your practice a more profitable and sustainable business. And now, here's your host.
Hi, I'm Zoe. I'm the Area Sales Manager for Practice Plan. Welcome to this week's podcast on practice management and team development. Today we're going to focus on employment law and things you need to know. So today we've got Sarah Buxter joining us, who's going to give us a valuable expert advice today. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
Hiya. On my travels, and obviously being in practice myself over the last 30 years, asked many questions around HR law and the complications around that. So would you be happy to ask if I ask you a couple of questions today?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, one of the main things that I do get asked is what people should include in their contract of employment.
Yeah, it's quite a popular one, and often practice owners can be confused about what clauses they have to include and what clauses they should include. But I think the first thing to note is that no two practices are the same. So what one practice will need in their employment contract will be totally different to another practice down the street. But the type of things that should be included, for example, the date of commencement of employment. This is the date on which the employee starts work, and it is a legal requirement that it's included in the contract. It's not the date on which the contract is signed, and that's really important because that's often confused. Another clause that should be included within the contract is whether there's a probationary period. This period is there to enable the employer to review the individual and their in the initial first 3 or 6 months. And if it's not working out, it gives the employer the ability to terminate the employment with short notice. One clause that doesn't have to be included, but which an employer may think is a good idea to include, is a warranty that the employee is entitled to work in the UK. It is a criminal offence, and there can be actual civil penalties if a practice owner employs an individual who does not have the right to work in the UK, and therefore it is encouraging the employee to provide information. Of course, it's not, it wouldn't prevent any prosecution, but it would be there to try and flush out information regarding whether they have the right work permit or are entitled to work in the UK. Another clause which should be included is a brief job description or a description of the employee's title. I always advise that this should be drafted as widely as possible to give the practice owner maximum flexibility. It's also important, and it is a legal obligation, that the employer specifies the employee's normal place of work. It should also include a clause which gives the practice owner flexibility to move the employee anywhere within a reasonable area. You may think that as a practice owner you only have one practice and therefore you're going to remove any clause that says that you can move them within a reasonable area. However, you never know what's going to happen in the future, and if you don't have that clause, which is known as a mobility clause, allowing you to move staff, unfortunately you won't be able to do so. So it's better to have that clause than not. A further clause which should be included is the hours of work. So you must provide the days of the week, the number of hours and the time. It may be that actually you have staff that are subject to a rota, and again, that's absolutely fine, but it needs to be included in the contract of employment. Coupled with this, you may want to consider whether, as a practice owner, you want to pay for overtime, and if so, again, this needs to be included in the contract. One thing that is often missed, in my experience by practice owners, is the fact that you cannot make a deduction from an employee's salary unless it is required or authorised by a statutory provision, or if the employee has previously consented in writing to the deduction. That means that you need a clause in your contract of employment stating that you, as the practice owner, has the right to deduct from wages. This clause can provide the necessary contractual authority that the practice owner needs to make this deduction, and without it, they're unable to do so. Holidays, that's another clause which by law a practice owner has to provide. Currently, they have to provide 5.6 weeks annual leave for a full-time member of staff, or that can be prorated for a part-time member of staff. It's also important within the contract at this state, within this clause, to be stating that how holiday is booked, how many weeks' notice do you need, and whether as a practice owner you need to reserve some of those holidays, so fix the holidays, especially if you are closed over the Christmas period, you may want to use some of those holidays for that time. Sometimes practice owners get confused that they believe that there's a statutory right for employees to be paid bank holidays. Currently we have 8 bank holidays, and there's no right for these to be paid. But what they can be is part of the statutory entitlement. It's not uncommon for practice owners to get confused, especially if they have a part-time worker who may not work on a Monday, as to whether they should be paid extra or given extra holiday. However, it should be borne in mind that if the bank holidays are part of the annual leave entitlement, then they should be paid them as part of their annual leave. Sickness absence, again, this might be something that you want to regulate within the contract, especially if you're paying an enhanced contractual sick pay. This doesn't tend to be the case anymore. But mostly, practices tend to pay statutory sick, but you do need to set out what the sickness absence procedure is and how they receive their sick pay. Something that's not obligatory, but as a dental practice you would want to ensure is included in the contract, is a clause regarding confidential information. There is an implied duty on an employee to keep confidential information, such as patient records, secret during the course of employment. However, this is only a limited implied right following termination of employment. So it's useful to have an expressed written clause in the contract stating that the confidential information which they may come into contact with during their time as an employee, whether it's patient records or business affairs, that they should keep this confidential once their employment comes to an end. Another clause that I often find is missed is a payment in lieu of notice clause. This is sometimes referred to as the pile-on clause, and this allows an employer to terminate the employment with immediate effect and make a payment of their basic salary in lieu of the employees working their notice. This can come in really handy if, for example, you're in a situation where you are making redundancies and you don't want that individual to be working in the practice during their notice period, and therefore you pay them their notice. You can only do that if there's a clause in the contract allowing you to do so. Talking about termination, it is important that you do have a termination clause setting out what notice is needed. For an employee, by law, they have to be provided with 1 week for every year's service up to a maximum of 12 weeks. If you want to provide more to an employee, that's absolutely fine, but that you must ensure that you comply with the minimum obligations. In respect of the employee providing notice, this is totally up to the employer. Usually across dental practices, it does depend on the individual role, but it can range from the employee having to provide 1 month to 3 months notice. This gives you the sufficient time to sort out a replacement if, for example, they decide to leave and you need to recruit quite quickly. Another clause which has to be provided by law is details of where the disciplinary and grievance procedures are contained. I always advise that they should be found in the staff handbook, and that the staff handbook should be in a place which is easily accessible to all employees. You don't have to regurgitate the disciplinary and grievance procedures as part of the contract, but they do. It does have to state where the employee can find access to these policies. Something at the moment which a lot of employers are having to update is the pension clause. So lots of clauses within a contract of employment will talk about a stakeholder pension. We've only just got auto enrolment coming in, so you will need to change and update your contracts to reflect the current situation. But again, an employer is obliged to state which pension they have in place. Finally, I should say that you can have any other clauses which suit you in your practice. So a popular one for dental practices would be what I refer to as the traineeship clause. So for example, if you have an employee who you've paid to train, and then at the end of the training they leave you, and your competitor has the benefit of that training, it's a little bit gutting, and therefore you can, if you write it into your contracts, have the right to take back some of the costs of that training, so that at least you're recouping some of the training costs if they decide to leave thereafter. But like I say, you can include any clauses in the contract of employment, and those are just a few of the very important ones that you're required to provide by law.
Thanks, Sarah. That's really useful. Thank you very much for that. The other thing that I often get asked, and obviously had to deal with it myself in the past, is poor timekeeping. So what would you say would be the correct method of dealing with that person that was always, you know, turning up late in the mornings?
Yeah, it can become really frustrating for a practice owner when they've got an employee who is constantly being late. But the most important key to this is communication. So really, you need to find out why that individual is being late. It may be that they have a disability that you're not aware of. It could be something like they're pregnant, or it could be something quite simple like they've just been stuck in traffic, and it may be the case that you tell them to get out of bed a bit earlier to get here on time. However, unless you have those conversations, you'll never find out why that individual is being late. If they don't have any mitigating circumstances, and you've already sat with them and tried to deal with it in an informal manner, so you've explained to them why it's important to be on time, then it's absolutely fine to use the disciplinary policy to discipline that member of staff. You have to bear in mind that any disciplinary is confidential, and it should be dealt with sensitively. That's really important to make sure that as an employer you don't end up being in breach of contract. But you should, part of the disciplinary policy, and you must follow whichever one suits your practice. But ultimately, they all tend to be along the same policy, which means that you invite the employee to a meeting, you explain within the letter, within the invitation, the allegations that they've been constantly late without any mitigating circumstances. You have to provide usually 5 working days notice of that meeting, And they have the right to be accompanied to that meeting by a trade union representative or a workplace colleague. It may be the case that if, for example, their English isn't very good or they have a disability, that you allow them to be accompanied by somebody else, such as a family member. But ultimately, an employee only has the right to bring a workplace colleague or trade union representative. At the hearing, there's usually a chair, and they are the person that ultimately makes the decision. It's also important to have somebody in the meeting taking minutes, but they will have no say or have any impact on the decision. At that meeting, you need to go over why the individual is being late and again check if they have any mitigating circumstances. If they don't, then you may make the decision that you're going to provide them with one of the outcomes that you'll probably find within your disciplinary policy. You should write to the employee with the outcome. Usually, the first, it would be being late, you would provide a first written warning. If it then escalated and they didn't improve, even though they were on the first written warning, you would go through the procedure again and you may wish then to give them a final written warning. Again, if they were on a final written warning and they still didn't improve, you could go through the procedure again and you can provide them with, you can terminate. It wouldn't be gross misconduct, so you would have to terminate their employment with notice. But this would be a really good situation where, for example, you may want to pay them in lieu of their notice. Alternatively, you could look at different options to dismissal, such as demotion or a reduction in pay, or that you may decide not to provide them with a bonus. But ultimately, the disciplinary procedure is there for a practice owner to use to try and manage that situation. And if an employee isn't improving, then there's no reason why you can't go through the three-stage process to bring their employment to an end. What I should add is that the employee does always have the right to appeal that decision. So when you're providing the outcome, whether it's the first written warning or the dismissal, the letter should inform the employee of how they can appeal the decision. And if they want to appeal, they need to set out their grounds within a limited period of time, which is usually 5 working days. And if they do appeal, then you would have to go through the process of inviting them to a further meeting. Again, they'd have the right to be accompanied to that meeting, and you would listen to the grounds of appeal. And then you would either confirm the original decision, revoke the original decision, or substitute for a different penalty. But again, what I would do is encourage practice owners to use the disciplinary policy if they find that informally they're not getting anywhere. Because there's only so many times you can have a conversation with an employee about how you want them to improve whatever it is. I mean, lateness is a very common one. But if they're not listening and they're not improving, the law does provide that the employer can go through a disciplinary procedure. And if they don't improve, unfortunately, it may result in an employee's dismissal.
Thanks, Sarah. That's great. I think, to be fair, I agree with you on the point of, you know, sometimes just making things formal has the effect that it needs. You know, that first warning can just be enough to have the effect that you're needing for the rest of the team, really. So yeah, I'd agree with you on that. I think making things formal does have the impact that that you need when you're running a practice. Another thing that I often get asked is long-term sickness, because that has a huge impact on practices, and it's sometimes difficult to know how to deal with this.
Yeah, I agree, and I think one of the benefits of practice, of being a dental practice, is that with sickness absence, if you've got somebody who's on long-term sick, you do have a legitimate reason to react and do something about it quite quickly, especially if you're a smaller practice. It's going to be proportionate for a practice owner to do something about it. What I would always say is don't leave it. Don't forget about the employee who's on long-term sick, and don't leave it until after their statutory sick pay has expired, as lots of practice owners tend to think they can't do anything about it until their statutory sick pay has expired. That's not the case. You should deal with it quite early on. Something else that often pops up in practice is that the practice owner or manager, they believe they can't contact an employee who's on long-term sick. And again, that's not the case. It's actually advisable for you to be keeping in contact with that employee, maybe every fortnight. You don't want to be harassing them, so you don't want to be contacting them every day, but every fortnight to see how they are, how they're getting on. And don't forget that just because an employee is on long-term sick doesn't mean that they shouldn't be invited to a social event such as the Christmas party. Lots of people take sickness for different reasons, and that doesn't mean that they can't attend a social event. But ultimately, it is recognised that it can cost a business a lot of money to have somebody on long-term sick. And therefore, when you're in this situation, there is a sickness absence capability procedure for a practice owner to use. It does involve inviting the employee in to a meeting. Again, they have the right to be accompanied to that meeting by a workplace colleague or trade union representative. Or because they're unwell, this may be the perfect situation where you say that's absolutely fine for them to bring a family member for additional support to the meeting. But again, that decision is with the employer. It's up to the employer whether they believe that suits this individual case. The purpose of the meeting is to try and find out a bit more about the illness, to discuss whether there's any chance of them returning to work, and it's meant to be a supportive meeting. Once you've found out a little bit more about whether they're ever going to be capable of doing their job again, or if it's going to be months or days before they come back to work. If they say it's going to be months, or I don't know if I'm going to be able to come back to work, then you need to obtain medical evidence, and that can be from a GP or an occupational health advisor. There are certain questions to ask the occupational health or the GP, but the idea is that you're finding out as much information as possible to see if the employee can return to work, and if they do return to work, if there's any reasonable adjustments you need to be making to assist them and support them with that return. The key here, and where lots of practice owners tend to slip up, is that they tend to make the decision themselves about the illness, and that they tend to make the decision that this employee will not be able to return to work. But I'm an employment lawyer, I can't make the decision, and dental practice owners will be dentists, so they're not in a position to make that decision. So they must obtain medical evidence, and that's often where employers can fall down by not obtaining that evidence. Once you've received that evidence, quite often the GP or the occupational health will say that they don't envisage that they'll be returning to work, or that it may be several months before they can return. And at that stage, you would want to have a further sickness absence meeting with the employee. Again, you need to write to them, provide them with notice of the meeting, and provide them the right to be accompanied to that meeting. If if it's quite clear that they're not capable, it may be that the only outcome of that meeting is termination. And termination will be with full notice or with payment in lieu of notice. The outcome of the meeting may be an alternative role, or it may be that you need to reduce their hours to encourage them back to work. But ultimately, if the GP or occupational health has said that they're incapable of coming back to work, then the practice owner is within their rights to terminate the employment. You should provide the outcome to the employee in writing. And again, the employee does have the right to appeal that decision, where you would have to go through the procedure again to consider their grounds for appeal and to decide whether the outcome was the right one. Basically, it does mimic a disciplinary procedure, but you're looking for different outcomes. And what I would say is that throughout capability and sickness absence, the idea is that as a practice owner, you're being supportive and you're looking for ways to help rather than looking for ways to dismiss. But ultimately, if dismissal is the only way forward, then you're within your rights to dismiss that individual.
Thanks, Sarah. I mean, another thing that we used to do is actually go out and visit the employees in their home as well, just to have the meetings to make them feel more comfortable, especially if they're off sick and it was sometimes difficult for them to get to the practice or the head office. So that's sometimes a really supportive thing to offer. But thanks for that. That's really good, actually. The other thing that I think has become a bit blurry over the past couple of years is the two-year sort of employee situation, whereas, you know, can I dismiss when they've not been employed for 2 years? I know that's quite blurry now, so perhaps you could clear that
up. I think the key to remember here is that an employee who has less than 2 years' service does not have the right to bring an unfair dismissal claim. But what they do have is the right to bring about 84 other claims. So, for example, if you dismissed an employee because they'd complained about something within the practice, that could be whistleblowing, and therefore that would be automatically unfair. Another situation, if you dismissed an employee who had less than 2 years' service because they fell pregnant, they're automatically protected, and therefore that would be automatically unfair. But generally, if an employee has less than 2 years' service, the risk of dismissing an employee is quite low risk. However, you do have to be careful because the discrimination legislation still applies. So if they have a protected characteristic, such as race, gender, marital status, age or disability, they could always claim that they were dismissed for one of those reasons. Therefore, it's really important that if you're dismissing an employee with less than 2 years' service, it doesn't come as a shock to them. Because if it's a complete and utter shock, they will look for other ways and another reason as to why they've been dismissed. So if you're dismissing them because they're underperforming, just make sure that you have had a few meetings with them explaining that they're not meeting their key performance indicators, why you're not happy with them. And then when you do come to dismiss, it's not such a shock for them and they don't look for another reason. So you just need to be a little bit careful. It's not a free-for-all. You can't dismiss everybody and anybody who has less than 2 years' service. But what it is it's relatively low risk. So you would still be okay to do it within the two-year period. After the two-year period, it becomes a little bit more difficult because they have protection generally under the unfair dismissal law, and that means that you have to have a good reason to dismiss, and you have to follow a procedure to dismiss.
Thank you, Sarah. I think the clear point here is to always take advice, because every situation is very different. It's always good to talk it through with someone that's got the expert advice. But thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.